The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. One of the intriguing or interesting aspects of Buddhism is that Buddhism offers a path, a journey. For people who like quests, it could be a quest. And it's often described as a journey to liberation, a path of liberation. But it could equally be described as a path of ethics, a path to ethical maturation. And there's a way of reading what the Buddha taught to see it as a journey, an ethical journey. And there's a number of reasons why we don't talk about it that way. One is that the concept of ethics is a kind of a Western concept that isn't really shared by Indian Buddhists or ancient Buddhists as a concept. From our point of view, the ancient Buddhists were very ethical, for sure. But they didn't kind of separate out ethics as something that was distinct by itself. It was just kind of integrated or part of everything else they taught. But we can, if we take our Western idea of ethics and see it as a path, an ethical path. And there's some benefits to doing that. One is that it highlights the value of becoming ethical, or that being ethical is kind of part and parcel of the path that we're on. And that hasn't always been taught in Buddhism, and hasn't always been taught here in the West. And often the idea of enlightenment is presented in some non-ethical terms that makes it very special and lofty. Sometimes it's offered in very personal terms, that the individual becomes free of their suffering, and that's nice. But in talking about ethics, I think ethics is relational. It has to do with how we live in the world together with others and the world and beings all around. And by talking about enlightenment in too personal terms, we miss that this whole path of Buddhism is deeply interrelational. It has to do with how we live our lives. The experience of enlightenment, the experience of liberation, is in fact talked about in ethical terms in this way, that enlightenment or liberation is the destruction of greed, hate, and delusion. Now, it's not obvious to many people why that greed, hate, and delusion are ethical, but in Buddhism, these three impulses, forces inside of us of greed, hatred, and delusion are called the three roots of all unwholesome or all unethical behavior. So if you're able to eliminate, extinguish these three roots of greed, hate, and delusion, then the roots, the conditions, the source for unethical behavior is not going to be there. Also, these three roots, greed, hate, and delusion, are considered to be painful in and of themselves. The English translation of one word is they're vexing. So I don't know how many of you use the word, go around saying vexing a lot, but they're painful or suffering. So by extinguishing greed, hate, and delusion, we remove these forces of our own vexation, our own suffering, pain, and also we remove the impulses that lead to unethical behavior in the world. So so this goal is seen in this way as an ethical goal. Those who become fully liberated are said to be trustworthy. And I love this idea that they're trustworthy. So they offer the gift of fearlessness. That there's no occasion to be afraid of them because they're not going to kill or steal or engage in sexual misconduct or lie or help you get intoxicated. So So what I'd like to do is to piece today, is to kind of piece together some of the different spread out teachings of the Buddha, that if you bring them together, it describes how this is an ethical path, kind of stages of growth developmentally. So it begins by being an unethical person. And an unethical person is considered completely unethical, has no interest in their own welfare or in the welfare of others. And that's kind of an interesting definition, that some people go around and killing and stealing and hurting through their sexuality and so forth, that in some ways they're not concerned with their own welfare. And they're not concerned with the welfare of others. Someone who is unethical, in the traditional definition in the time of the Buddha, is in fact someone who kills, steals, engages in sexual misconduct, lies, and gets intoxicated. And such a person, the Buddha has an interesting name or designation for such a person. Here in the West, there's sometimes the idea of, you know, this fundamental kind of idea of a bad person is to be a sinner. And the opposite is to be a saint. And I think to see someone as a sinner is a very heavy condemnation. And they're kind of like, you can't really do anything on your own to free yourself from your sin. You're kind of stuck there. And the consequences are quite dire here, at least here in the West. A similar kind of word for someone who's unethical for the Buddha is someone who's a fool. And the opposite is not a saint, but rather a wise person. And a fool is someone who doesn't understand, but could understand. A wise is someone who understands already. And so the fool is not a condemnation, but in a sense, maybe it's a kind of a belittling of someone that is encouraging them to do something about their foolishness, get wise. So it's an ethical category to be a fool, because it's a title that's given to people who go around doing these awful things, killing and stealing and such things. So in some ways, given how serious the crimes are, to call them a fool is actually in some ways kind of, is it fair to say, kind of gentle? You know, it's kind of, you know, makes them, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not condemning them or ostracizing maybe someone. It's saying, look, you're foolish and get wise. So the next level of an ethical journey is to avoid these five behaviors. It's called the five abstentions. One abstains from killing, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from lying, and from intoxication. And it seems that the Buddha kind of had an attitude that if a ordinary person who wasn't a Buddhist was a good person, that's what they would do. They would abstain from those five things. And those who did that, he sometimes called them a child of a good family, kulaputta. And this isn't just a good family here, means like it's a little bit like an aristocratic family. It's kind of like a term of kind of hierarchy, but he's ready to apply that to anyone, even if they're not literally part of the aristocracy of the time. So if you live by these five abstentions, then you're a good person. However, if he would have said, if you want to be a superior person, if it's not good enough to be a good person, but if you want to be a superior person, then he said, not only do you live by these five abstentions, but you also encourage other people to do so. So there is a kind of little bit, I don't know if it's missionary quality, but there is a kind of, you know, this relational aspect of Buddhism is important, that we want to try to encourage others also to not harm people around us. Then a person becomes, as in this journey towards the Buddhist enlightenment, a person becomes goes for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. So they become kind of a follower of the Buddha. But many times in the suttas, in the ancient literature, there are lots of people who are inspired by the Buddha and go to him for refuge, go for him, kind of declare that they're kind of followers, or, you know, they put themselves into the under the Buddha's guidance. And occasionally, there are people who do so and commit themselves to these five abstentions. So by now, you're getting a sense of these five abstentions of not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, not lying, and not getting intoxicated are pretty important for this early tradition. It's like the standard, the ethical standard that somehow is being used repeatedly. And so some people then do both. And it seems like the Buddha encouraged this. Nowhere in the ancient literature does the Buddha actually say he expects or requires someone to abide by these five abstentions. But I think my best guess is that's because in the polite language of ancient India, you didn't tell people to do something. You just kind of said, oh, you know, a wise person does the five abstentions. And he looks at you. You know, like, you know, get on with it. But you know, you wouldn't actually say that. But, you know, he did kind of say, that he did say, you know, someone who's a follower of, you know, a lay follower becomes accomplished in virtue if they abide by these five abstentions. They don't cause harm to others. But then, as part of this kind of ethical training, lay people have an option to up their game a little bit. And one way to up their ethical game back in ancient India was to go to to church on Sunday, which meant in that ancient India, but it was not church, but what they meant was every 2 weeks on the full moon and the new moon, that was the observance day. And that's when all the monastics would gather together in order to renew their precepts, their ethical training rules, and to, if they had somehow violated them, to do a little confession and kind of start fresh. And that became the custom for lay people to visit the monastic communities during those days, and it was kind of like a holiday day. It was kind of like a, you know, day off, I guess, and you'd go to the monastic community where the monks and nuns were hanging out, and you would spend the day there. Apparently, sometimes a day and the night. It was like a whole day and night, 24 hours of religious, or say differently, ethical festivities. And so what they would do is that they had the option during those 24 hours to commit themselves to 8 precepts. So that, you know, upping their game, not just the 5 abstentions. And these 5 are the 5 abstentions: not killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, or intoxication, but also not to engage in, maybe we could call, distracting entertainment. Don't go to shows, don't listen to music, and also don't adorn oneself. Don't put on a lot of makeup and jewelry and things like that, that apparently both men and women in ancient India did. There's a description of men who were completely made up in apparently heavy, heavy makeup. So it was apparently a popular thing to do. And so, but you wouldn't do that. You'd live a life of simplicity during that 24 hours. You would also not sleep or rest in luxurious beds or sofas or something. So, you know, you're supposed to not, you know, indulge in luxury. And then also you're supposed to only eat one meal a day. And that meal had to be eaten before noon. So again, here's a life of simplicity. And that. So that's kind of upping the game for a while. But then a person can become a practitioner. you know, engage in the kind of what we call not just ethical abstentions, but also start doing practices. And the core practice that's emphasized over and over again in Buddhism are a set of eight practices called the Eightfold Path. And this Eightfold Path is an interesting collection of practices that have usually has a prefix to each one, an adjective that is usually translated into English as right. And, you know, right and wrong are kind of ethical, I suppose, though most teachers like me will bend over backwards and say it doesn't mean right and wrong, it means something else, but maybe we're overdoing it. So right. And they're right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. The middle three, right action, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, are clearly ethical in nature and are treated that way by the tradition. And so right speech is not to lie, not to use divisive speech, not to use harsh speech, and not to use frivolous speech. Right action is not to kill, not to steal, and not to engage in sexual misconduct. And right livelihood, the simplest definition of right livelihood, is avoid wrong livelihood. So I don't want to get into it more than that for now. However, the second of the Eightfold Path factors is called right intention, usually in English. And part of that is to have the intention of what's called non-ill will and non-harming. To have the intention not to harm is expected of people who are cultivating, developing the path to awakening. Cultivating that non-ill will is also kind of expected as part of the training. So these are also ethical in nature. In the ancient Pali language, when an ethical quality is stated in the negative, it implies the positive. So non-harming is said to imply compassion, and non-ill will implies kindness. The seventh factor in the Eightfold Path is mindfulness. And now the ethical cultivation development of the person gets more interesting. Because now it's not about abstentions, what you don't do, and it's not about just the intention you have, but rather it's about, we're beginning to cultivate an ethical character, a mind or heart that is predisposed or has a characteristic of being ethical in nature. And mindfulness itself is described by the Buddha as something that cultivates or develops an ethical quality. A person who is mindful will tend to be more and more ethical. One description of this, he says that if there's a big mound of dirt on the crossroads, so there's places where two roads cross, it's a big, big mound of dirt. If a chariot comes along and goes back and forth and back and forth over it, eventually that mound is flattened out. In the same way, if you do practice the four foundations of mindfulness, these four roads that meet in the crossroads, I guess, and you practice these cultivate awareness of the body, awareness of feeling, of mind states, and of what's called dharmas, or inner mental processes, if you really get to know yourself well, pay attention to your inner life really well, over and over and over again you're mindful. Day after day after day you practice mindfulness. Then it's like going over this mound of dirt and flattening it. And what he says is the mound of your unwholesome mental qualities, unwholesome, unethical kind of tendencies, will get flattened. Isn't that nice? I guess kind of destroyed from the practice of mindfulness. The Buddha also talked about how you become more ethical if you practice mindfulness of the body. There's something about paying careful attention to your body, the state of your body, the tensions in your body, the sense of freedom, the ease, pleasure that can come in the body, that lends itself to a person becoming ethical. So there's one teaching of the Buddha called the Discourse on Mindfulness Directed to the Body. And there he gives a series of practices to do in terms of paying attention to the body. And then he describes how you do this practice of mindfulness up through developing the jhanas. The jhanas are deep meditative states that are characterized by pervasive feelings of joy, of happiness, equanimity, and peace. And so what happens when your whole experience is characterized, your sense of being is characterized by joy, happiness, and equanimity, is that there's very little room for unethical behavior. In fact, the Buddha was explicit that all unwholesome thoughts and all unwholesome intentions have to be stilled, have to be settled and quieted down in order to get into these deep states of concentration. And so you're all the unwholesome agitation, all the unwholesome kind of feelings of anger and hostility and maybe unethical kind of greed, lust, has been quieted down, and it's been replaced by a feeling of a sense of inner ethical purity. And it's quite a contrast between feeling, knowing kind of the unethical lust and hate and forces inside of us, and then feeling an alternative to that. To really know that palpably, viscerally inside, a feeling of ethical cleansiness or wholeness or, you know, goodness that might be here. And to have that as a reference point, to know that that's possible, is a kind of game changer for many people. Because, wow, why would I go back to get all, you know, maybe, I don't know if that's the best language, but to get all dirty once I got clean? You know, you took a lot of work to get yourself, your hair all clean, and then you don't go out in your garden and just find good mud and kind of, you know, smear it in. That would, you know, wouldn't, and then you know, that doesn't feel good. So so the idea is once you manage to do the work of getting yourself internally clean, then you know something you don't know before. And for me, when I experienced this, it was only then that I understood something about how my inner life had been unwholesome. It was so kind of, it wasn't like I was a terribly unwholesome person, but I had my tendencies. And but I kind of thought it was just part of life. I was kind of naive and innocent maybe and whatever. And they were just there, and I didn't even think they were wrong to have or, you know, undesirable to have. But once through meditation, I tasted this inner freedom, cleansiness, purity, ethical wholeness, something like that. One of the words I liked for myself was integrity, this inner integrity. Then I understood what these other things were in me. And so this is not interesting. Why would I get involved and do this? So this is part of this movement towards becoming ethical. And the Buddha said that if you do this well, then Mara is kind of like the Buddhist bad guy, the Buddhist devil. It's usually seen as a personification of the inner unwholesome forces that we can have. That those unwholesome forces, Mara, cannot get access to you and will not have a foothold in you. So there's no foothold, meaning there's no place to stand. They don't have any place to stand and do anything. Mara can't get access to you, and you can't force you to do things that you don't want to do. It's kind of a nice thing to kind of have this. You have a kind of a, I don't know if a shield, but it's, the way the language is used in these texts, the analogy, it's just like like a jug of water or a pond which is full to the brim. And so nothing can get poured in there because it's full. So if you're filled with inner goodness, unwholesome things can't get into you. That's pretty good, but not good enough. And because here, the ethical nature of a person is there because the person has developed a strong states of concentration, strong enough states of concentration to have this. And so it can disappear when the concentration state decreases. And so one of the functions of liberation, of enlightenment, is to make the ethical state more permanent. So it's not something that comes and goes. It's not dependent on your concentration level. And it's not dependent on the effort you make, the diligent effort you might make to abide by the abstentions, to try to be ethical and pay attention, watch yourself, and keep yourself in check. Part of the function of liberation is to turn yourself into such an ethical person that being ethical becomes a natural aspect of who you are. You become ethical rather than you act ethically. So the first stage of doing so is becoming what's called a stream enterer. One enters the stream, so one's in the current that will take one all the way to full liberation, to the full ethical maturation. And so what does it mean to enter that stream? How does one enter the stream? There's many descriptions in the suttas. One of the ones that's my favorite has an ethical component to it. So there are within us, I shouldn't use the word us. They don't want to assume. There are in some people, occasionally, maybe in one or two of you, such forces, psychological tendencies towards lust, greed, covetousness, ill will, anger, conceit, arrogance, desire to dominate over other people, envy, and so forth. And there's Buddha lists 16 of these things. So if your ability to pay careful attention notices that when these things arise in you, that you actually doesn't feel good to have them there. He uses the language of defilement or impurity. Maybe here, and some people here in the West prefer more polite categories than defilements. Maybe to really want to be careful and polite, you say, just unnecessary states of mind. Maybe. Anyway, you can notice these 16 defilements of the mind. And the reason why the word defilement is sometimes used, it's synonymous with afflictive states. These are states that hurt. If I say just unnecessary or something very too polite and nice, it loses the flavor. This is actually harmful for it to have these states. So first person knows, recognize these as being defilements, being afflictive. And then the person is able to abandon them, these states. And abandon is not simply suppressing them or holding them in check, is at least temporarily letting them go long enough and fully enough that a person has the experience of the mind or the heart without any of these present. This is part of the education of our potential. Wow, this is cool, this is wonderful. This feels so much better. This is refreshing. This feels clean. This feels really great not to have these forces present. To be able to experience for oneself that difference, if I use the word ethical, that ethical difference between having inner psychological tendencies that are unethical and have them disappear, that is to become a stream enterer. That's become the first level of awakening. That is to know what the Buddha, what the Dharma, some essence of what the Dharma is about. It's a psychological understanding. It's not something mystical. It's not something kind of supernatural. But rather, it's understanding your own mind in an ethical way and to experience for yourself in a direct way the possibility of having what in modern West we can call an ethical mind, a wholesome mind, a mind of integrity, a mind that's free. If a person has this experience, stream enter, then it's said that it's impossible for a person to do anything that's so unethical that they'll get reborn in hell. So that's kind of convenient. And in Buddhism, hell is not so bad to be reborn in hell. I mean, the descriptions that some of these ancient texts give of what it's like there are pretty bad. And there's a TV show called The Good Place. Has anybody watched it? They have wonderful descriptions of the bad place. And it was just kind of like the hell, I guess. And it's a kind of, it has a lot of ethics in it, this TV show called The Good Place. But anyway, Buddhism has great their own descriptions. They're not going to be outdone by anybody else's descriptions. So they're going to really do well. And but what's, you know, why it's kind of, you know, better to be born in the Buddhist hell than some other people's hells is because it's always temporary. You know, it's only going to last you a few tens of millions of years. But it's not for eternity. So it's a relatively short time. You'll get over it. Excuse me for a minute while I find the quote I wanted to read. So someone who has this first stage of awakening called a stream enterer is described as possessing the virtuous behavior of noble ones, unbroken, untorn, unblemished, unmodeled, free, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to concentration. So if you experience this, there's something about this very strong experience of stream entry where something's abandoned thoroughly enough that the person now starts behaving virtuously. Also, they have certain virtues. If they're a lay person, they dwell at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. And then there's a very interesting description of what happens to someone who becomes a stream enterer, and that is they no longer have attachments, they're no longer attached to ethical behavior, ethical rules, and to religious observations, the religious kind of rituals and stuff like that. So, no longer attached to religious behavior? I mean, now we're getting into dangerous territory. But you're liberated, you can do whatever you want. No. What it means is that before this transformation, or this change, interchange that happens, these unhealthy tendencies and impulses might exist in people. They might get angry, they might lie, they might do all kinds of things. Under enough stress, good people sometimes will kill and do terrible things. And so up until this point, a person has to hold on to, be committed to, kind of through an act of kind of will, to restrain themselves to avoid doing unethical things. And so the precepts, the commitment to not kill and lie and so forth, steal, is something one does. So one has to adhere to it. After stream entry, one no longer needs to adhere to it. One no longer needs to be attached to it because now it's become internalized. The state of one's mind, the character of the person, one's inner nature is starting to become ethical. They're not 100% ethical, but they're ethical enough not to get reborn in hell. And they're very unlikely to violate the five precepts. So they won't kill, they won't steal, they won't lie, they won't engage in sexual misconduct or in intoxication. But they still have what's called the three roots. They still have forces of greed, hate, and delusion. these ethical sources of, the source of unethical behavior. The next stage of awakening, so there's four stages. The second stage is diminishing, reducing the strength of greed, hate, delusion inside of a person. So that's nice. And so they're not so strong anymore. The third stage is to eliminate the attachment to sensual desire and any kind of attachment to ill will, or not even attachment, to the impulse to ill will is eradicated. And I think it's fair to say that the drive for sensual, for lust for sensual pleasure, and the drive for that brings ill will and hostility, that those are kind of ethical, unethical kind of drives. And to have them eliminated from the mind is an ethical movement. This makes the person more ethical. And then the fourth stage of awakening is that of an arhat. And this is the person who becomes trustworthy. And it's a little quote that the Buddha had where he said, an arhat becomes trustworthy as they walk, trustworthy as they stand, trustworthy as they sit down, and trustworthy lying down. No matter whatever posture, whatever situation they're in, they're trustworthy. They're someone that we can put our trust in. We can trust they're not going to harm us. so here's a an arhat, so a fully enlightened person, has banished all evil states. So there's no more unwholesomeness, no more evil, no more just defined. This person's defined by being ethically pure. If there's no unwholesome roots, no unwholesome kind of thoughts and feelings inside, then there's no cause to intentionally be unethical, consciously be unethical. So it's not a matter of choosing to be unethical, just a person is ethical by nature. This is a description. Those arhats with taints destroyed, who are completely liberated, they are incapable of transgressions in 9 cases. They are incapable of deliberately depriving a living being of life. And here it's not just people, any living being. They are incapable of taking what is not given. They are incapable of stealing. It's interesting that they distinguish between these two. Usually stealing is considered the same as not taking what is not given. And here they treat them as two separate categories. They are incapable of indulging in sexual intercourse. So now some of you are not going to want to be interested in becoming fully liberated. You know, I'll take part of it. It's like St. Augustine who said, give me chastity, but later. Something like that. I guess the Buddhist version would be, give me enlightenment, but only partially. Because they say that somehow there's something about this full enlightenment, full liberation, that a person then apparently has no more sexual urge at all, no more intercourse. We're not going to advertise that too broadly. The person who is fully liberated is incapable of knowingly speaking falsehoods. They're incapable of enjoying sensual pleasures by storing them up. So you can have sensual pleasure, you know, go out and feel a nice sunny day or something, but you can't store up your sensual pleasure, store them up. You can't save them and gather them all together to, you know, be able to kind of enjoy them tomorrow. They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't kind of go through the trouble. They would just kind of be content with the pleasures that come their way as they live their life, but they're not going to do anything in order to optimize them. They're incapable of entering upon a wrong path on account of desire. Wrong ethical path. And they're incapable of entering upon a wrong path on account of delusion. And then the last one is kind of interesting. Incapable of entering upon a wrong path on account of fear. How often are people unethical because they're afraid? It's kind of very touching and very important to consider the role of fear. And maybe more unethical things happen in our life because of fear, maybe, than because of any other thing. So, and I'll end with a poem, and then a little statement. That this describes an arhat, and the Buddha had a wonderful tendency of appropriating certain words that were popular in the culture and redefining them. And one of those words was Brahmin. Brahmin was kind of a social status of people who were the high social status, and they would, it was a class of people who were born into being Brahmins, the highest class. The Buddha redefined what it meant to be Brahmin, so it wasn't a social class, but it was anyone who was living, was an arhat, someone who was living ethically, fully ethically. So here, this is a definition of the fully enlightened person. Having given up violence toward beings both timid and strong, whoever neither kills nor causes others to kill, I call a Brahmin. So this, here we have an ethical definition of awakening. So in summary, to make an ethical summary of the Buddha's teachings, avoiding behavior that harms lies at the heart of the Buddha's ethical teaching. Letting go of mental states that harm lies at the heart of the Buddha's meditation teaching. Eliminating the underlying roots of all harming tendencies lies at the heart of the Buddha's wisdom teaching. So, for those of you who are inclined, you might want to engage in the Buddhist path journey as a journey of ethical maturation. For those of you who get turned on by discussion, turned off, some people hopefully get turned on by this, ethics. But those of you who get turned off by this discussion about ethics, then just go for enlightenment all the way to be like a really fantastic, wonderful person. And in the process of doing that, you'll become ethical anyway. Thank you.